This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. They're in it for the long haul, fatigued, short of breath, continuing to exhibit symptoms months after contracting COVID-19. A subset of COVID-19 patients, many young or middle-aged and by all accounts healthy prior to their diagnosis, now experiencing a wide variety of medical problems, ranging from feeling like their brains are foggy to being diagnosed with glaucoma. They're known as the long haulers, and we're going to learn more about why some people are experiencing these long-term health effects after COVID-19 today on the show. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by a UVM pulmonologist and ICU doctor who's been working with some of these patients in Vermont, and she'll be able to answer your calls and emails. And we tried to get a Vermont patient to join us on the show today to share their experience with this. But as you can imagine, it's tricky to say yes to such a public forum. We're going to talk now, though, with Emma Goldberg, a reporter and researcher for The New York Times, who's written about the experiences of COVID-19 long haulers and talked with several of them. Emma, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me on today.
So I'm curious when you started hearing about these people who were not recovering from COVID-19, who weren't in the hospital, they weren't on respirators necessarily. It wasn't that they had had this acute experience with the virus, but they weren't fully recovering weeks and months after contracting it. How did you start to hear about this happening?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, I cover healthcare and the medical system for The Times. So toward the beginning of the pandemic, I was speaking with medical providers, patients, and others about what the experience of the pandemic was like in the hospitals, especially in New York City. And after a couple of weeks, I started to hear more about from these patients, I started to be encouraged to also speak with people who were at home and who were experiencing the virus and the disease, not in the hospitals, but actually in their own apartments, but still suffering in tremendous ways. And I actually also had some friends and even coworkers who experienced the disease themselves and were starting to realize that even after a couple of weeks, their symptoms weren't going away. And that was what led me to a couple of the support groups that are gathering thousands of these long haulers online, particularly Survivor Corps and Body Politic, where people are convening to share advice and to share their stories. And through those groups, I started to get connected to patients who are experiencing what this long haul COVID really feels like.
Yeah. And can you describe what being a long hauler actually means, what the typical, if there are typical symptoms are, and who are the long haulers?
Absolutely. I think what's tough is that there isn't exactly typical symptoms. It varies so much for each person. And one thing that's come out more and more is that it's not just the scratchy throat or the shortness of breath that we've all come to associate with COVID-19. There's a lot of other symptoms as well. There are people experiencing gastrointestinal symptoms, people experiencing headaches, fatigue, inability to exercise or inability to work as usual. So there's a wide range of symptoms. And some of the long haulers themselves are undertaking great efforts to survey one another and start to do some patient-led research about what those symptoms actually are. And the duration of the symptoms also really varies. So some people are experiencing the symptoms for 2 months, some people for going on 6 months. And I think we're going to need to continue examining the stories of these people, and we're going to need more clinical research as well to really know what it means to be a long hauler.
You mentioned some of the symptoms that people are experiencing and stated, you know, there's this wide array. I've heard of people having rashes. I mentioned glaucoma. One woman said she's developed glaucoma after having COVID-19. But there are also some sort of insidious symptoms as well, like anxiety and sadness that a lot of long haulers exhibit. And I can imagine that if you have an illness that is not very well understood and nobody knows how long it's going to last, you could have accompanying anxiety and sadness. Is there a sense that that's actually a symptom of being a long hauler, of this sort of post-COVID, whatever you want to call it, condition? Or is that some sort of a knock-on effect of having something that is so little understood?
That's a great question. And it's something that I think that that medical researchers still need to do more work to look into. One of the things that I found while interviewing people for my story is that there's just so many different factors that are breeding anxiety and depression and other mental health problems for long haulers. And that can be the inability to exercise, which is really important for mental health. The inability to see friends, family, and community, also critical for mental health. The inability to have a normal work routine, which, you know, the National Alliance on Mental Illness says can be helpful for people's mental health. All of those changes to someone's normal life and routine can breed serious mental health problems. And, you know, some of the people who have done these great patient-led surveys have found that anxiety is a widespread symptom experienced by long haulers. It's difficult to know how much that's tied to all the underlying changes that are caused in someone's life by experiencing COVID symptoms for such a long time.
One of the other complications that you mention in your reporting is that some or many maybe long haulers are saying people don't necessarily believe them when they say, no, really, I really am still sick.
Yes, that's critical. And there is a long history to especially female patients being sort of dismissed when they present their symptoms to doctors or having their pain levels be questioned. Or neglected. And we're definitely seeing that kind of gaslighting play out when it comes to long haulers. And I think another challenge is that not everybody can get access to a test. Particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, it was hard for a lot of people to get tested. And experiencing these symptoms for months, but not actually having the positive test result to show that you had COVID-19 can be a real problem for people when they're trying to express their symptoms to doctors, to employers, even to friends and family.
In your reporting, have you found that medical professionals are skeptical of some of these self-reported symptoms as well?
You know, not the medical professionals that I myself have spoken to. I have heard from the patients that they went to the doctor and they felt gaslit because they were told this might not be COVID-19, this might be allergies, or your shortness of breath might be related to anxiety. So people have felt dismissed, and I think that's also because there is so much new information coming out week to week, and medical providers are scrambling and working hard to keep up. So there are certainly gaps in information, there's gaps in knowledge, and you're seeing that sometimes manifest in patients feeling like they're not being fully heard.
As I mentioned, we are going to speak with a pulmonologist and an ICU doctor in just a few minutes who is working with some of these long haulers who certainly understands that this is happening and is real. But, you know, curious to know what's happening in the wider medical profession as we speak here with Emma Goldberg. And Emma, you mentioned that you mentioned women. You sort of singled out women are experiencing some of this gaslighting and being told that their symptoms aren't necessarily real. And it sounds like women make up a significant portion of long haulers. So there does seem to be a gender dynamic here in who is still experiencing these long-term symptoms.
Yes, and Ed Young from The Atlantic has done some great reporting on that mm-hmm. as well. And I think where the gender dynamic is particularly critical for long haulers is just this history of women not always being believed in clinical and medical settings or feeling that their pain levels are being dismissed. And that's all the more important to keep in mind when we have a disease that's so novel and one in which doctors have to confront their own gaps in knowledge and understanding, because that's where the tendency to dismiss women's pain levels can be particularly insidious.
Can you talk a little bit, Emma, about what you found in these long hauler support groups? You mentioned that people are coming together and in some cases keeping lists or sort of tallying their own symptoms together to try to get a handle on this. But you've sort of not infiltrated, that's the wrong word, but you have spent time looking at what these support groups are and how they operate and what purpose they serve.
Yeah, and, you know, I've heard it described by some of the patients as life-saving because a lot of them did, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, feel so isolated. And, you know, they were told this is a disease that might last 2 weeks if you have a mild case. And yet they were going on a month, 2 months with symptoms. So finding these communities of people who were experiencing similar problems was really meaningful and helpful for them. One point that I do want to make that's important is that some of them have found that it's helpful to limit the amount of time that they spend daily on these support groups, because if you spend too much time reading about others' negative experiences and symptoms, you can actually start to exacerbate your own anxiety and fall into a bit of a spiral. Also, it's critical that the groups themselves take it upon themselves to moderate and root out any misinformation, because there is the possibility people can share kind of unverified medical sources. And what's great is that some of these groups have committed to moderating content or to asking people to share a verified medical source when they're offering any specific medical advice.
You know, you can understand too, though, when it seemed like the general advice was, oh, if you're pretty healthy, you're going to get over this in a couple of weeks if you didn't need to go to the hospital. And these long haulers are, say, experiencing something very different that doesn't seem to be reflected in the media or in the sort of general understanding of the virus, that these support groups would be really essential. Emma, what are you finding in terms of what is needed next by the medical profession and by the media in terms of figuring out, you know, how to actually characterize these kinds of symptoms and this long-term illness?
Definitely. Well, one thing I think that's critical is looking ahead to the coming months, it is very possible that we'll see another surge of COVID-19 cases, particularly as the weather gets colder in the Northeast and people spend more time indoors where there's a greater risk of transmission of the virus. So we need to be thinking about how to really prepare. The medical community needs to be thinking about how to prepare to offer the best treatment if the number of cases rise. And I think one thing that's comforting speaking to physicians and epidemiologists is that it seems like hospitals are getting more and more comfortable with protocols for treating the worst cases. So now I think it's incumbent on the medical community to think about how to also treat those non-hospitalized cases, people who are dealing with this at home, people who are dealing with the long haul symptoms. As they're getting that, as the medical community is doing more and more to understand what treatment looks like for the most severe cases, they also need to think about the full spectrum and particularly the long haulers.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your research and reporting with us and what you've heard from some of the people that you've interviewed. Emma, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on today, and thanks for bringing this news to your listeners.
Emma Goldberg is a reporter and researcher for The New York Times who's written about the experiences of COVID-19 long haulers, and we have a link to her reporting at vpr.org. We're joined for the rest of the hour by Dr. Catherine Menson, adult pulmonologist and ICU intensivist at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Menson, thanks for being on Vermont Edition. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we were talking a little bit with Emma Goldberg, a reporter for The New York Times, about what she's found in her reporting on this. Did that resonate with what you're finding as a doctor working with these patients?
Yes, certainly. The surprising part about this has been patients who are coming into our clinic who have not necessarily been so sick that they needed ICU or even hospitalization were able to have their initial illness at home without having to be hospitalized, but now even months later are still dealing with these long-term manifestations of the disease.
Do you have a sense of how frequently this is happening? You know, is this a large minority of people who have mild cases, a small minority?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a difficult time in Vermont because we have been so successful at kind of keeping our case numbers low. The data that's been published within the medical community has shown that weeks out, patients were still having symptoms. It seemed to be about 30% of patients who initially tested positive would still have symptoms 2 to 4 weeks after their initial illness. We don't have a lot of information yet on any further data after that timeline. So we're still kind of waiting on things to reassess these patients at months out.
And that's only patients who were officially diagnosed, had a test, and were officially diagnosed with COVID-19, not necessarily people who, especially earlier in the pandemic, may not have been tested or may have been tested late and therefore aren't counted among the official ranks?
That's exactly right.
So is your sense that it could be higher than 30% for those who were not accounted for by official testing?
Yes, because there were so many limitations early on in the pandemic, there's certainly going to be a group of patients, as Ms. Goldberg said, either who were not tested initially or did not have access to testing, that could also be developing these long-haul symptoms.
We have a lot more questions to ask you, and we can go through who you're working with and what you're finding and what more research needs to be done. But we also have a lot of people who are already calling in, and some of whom are worried that this may be happening with them. Mm-hmm. So understanding that, Dr. Menson, you can't give out medical advice. You know, you're not officially the doctor of people mm-hmm. who are calling in, but you may be able to offer some general advice mm-hmm. or some ideas on where they could turn in their specific situations. I'm going to go to some of the calls. And let's start with Joanne, who's calling in from Fairfield. Hi, Joanne. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for letting me speak. I guess I just wanted to share a little bit of my story. I live in Fairfield, and I first got symptoms on March 17th. I'm a teacher, and it was right when school was getting ready to shut down. And my first symptom was just intense fatigue and headache. And then as the weeks went on, I got sore throat, low-grade fever, diarrhea, body aches, just everything, loss of taste and smell, shortness of breath. And my first positive test came back March 24th. I went to the ER. I've gone to the ER four times, twice in April. I was diagnosed with secondary pneumonia. And then again at the end of April, when I thought I was having a heart attack, they did notice I was having some abnormal EKG, but I didn't have a heart attack. I stayed positive all through May. They wanted me to see a pulmonologist and a cardiologist, but I had to get two negative tests to see anybody in person. And I wasn't able to do that until June 19th. So I've also had, strange eyes, like shaky eyes. I've had syncope. I've had horrible sore throats. And then the gastrointestinal stuff started. And that landed me in the ER again in July. And I had to have some, IV fluids and anti-nausea medicine. And they did some imaging of my stomach to see what was going on, but everything comes back unremarkable.
Joanne, what are you thinking as you experience all of this? Tell me what you're feeling, and then we'll get another call in here.
The really good thing is I found Survivor Corps, and that was a lifesaver for me. I guess what I really want, this is day 189 for me. I had to go to the ER last week, thought I was having a heart attack, and now I have ground glass opacity in my lungs. I'm actually going to UVM tomorrow to have a nuclear stress test on my heart because I have been diagnosed with tachycardia and other things. And I will see a pulmonologist again on Friday. I guess I was trying to work remotely, and my doctor finally said last week, I need to take September and October off because once I try to work, the fatigue hits me again and the heart and the shortness of breath. I just want people to know that we're out here, that it isn't, that it's real. It's terrible what it does to your brain, your whole body. And it's scary. And I hear people saying, I respect Governor Scott and Dr. Levine so much. I really do. But when they say the word recovered, it just gets me because although I'm technically recovered, this doesn't feel like recovery.
And I hear you on that. And that's such an interesting point, that question of, what is officially considered recovered? Is it no longer infectious? Or is it like somebody who can say, I feel healthy again, and I'm so sorry to hear that you're going through all of this, and I hope that the September and October break helps at least get you to a place where you feel slightly better. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Before we come back to you, Dr. Menson, let's go to David, who's calling in from Wheelock. David, you're also experiencing symptoms long after what you think was COVID-19?
Yes. Actually, my story is very similar to Joanne's. I am also a teacher. I'm late 40s, pretty physically active person, very healthy, generally hardly ever got sick. March 13th, I started getting shortness of breath, dry cough, and I do have mild asthma, so, you know, very, very mild, hardly bothers me. So I didn't think too much of it. I thought, well, maybe I'm coming out of the cold. Second week, all of a sudden I got slammed. I had GI symptoms. I had, you know, terrible shortness of breath. I felt like someone was sitting on my chest, couldn't stop coughing, dizzy spells. I had neurological symptoms like facial paralysis, all kinds of bizarre things. I'd sweat through my sheets like, you know, for about 4 or 5 days. And then I started to feel somewhat better. I thought, okay, well, that was unpleasant. Maybe it was COVID. I don't know. But, you know, it was the sickest I'd ever been in my life. But I stayed out of the hospital. I got through it. But then I just didn't get better. It went on for week after week with my lungs. And then in April, I started developing bizarre cardiac symptoms, these tachycardias, symptoms that kind of suggested myocarditis. I felt like my heart was being squeezed. I felt a lot of pain in my chest, and my heart would race, or I'd have palpitations out of nowhere. I also went to the ER, like, you know, once because I thought I was having a heart attack. And so that was kind of through April. May, my lungs blew back up again, and I kind of felt almost as bad as I did that second week. And it really wasn't until June that I started kind of feeling somewhat normal, although every time I would start to feel better, I'd exert myself, and within 24 hours, my lungs would blow up again. And that basically followed me all through June and July. It wasn't really until August, at the five-month marker, that my lungs started to feel somewhat better. And I've kind of been more careful about managing my exertion. And as long as I'm careful, I seem to be doing okay. I still have some flare-ups now and then, but not as bad as earlier. And you know, and so I guess one of the things I do want to tell people who are struggling with this is to kind of, you know, keep the faith and try to stay positive. You know, I know everyone's recovery is different. Mine was about 5 months, and even at 6 months, I still have some symptoms, but I do feel like I am finally getting better. But man, it was really hard. There was some times through April and May and June where I just really struggled, feeling like I was just stuck like this and I was going to be sick forever. It's definitely a really scary thing.
Boy, David, it sounds like it. And I'm glad to hear that you're starting to feel significantly better. Thank you for that. One more from Lisa in Albany, Vermont. Hi, Lisa. What about for you? What are you experiencing?
Hi. I did test positive. I'm a teacher as well, and I tested positive last April. Just after school shut down, I started getting sick. And I'm not as bad. I feel, I'm sorry for David, but similar things. I have felt like, had pain in my heart every now and then, after I supposedly am recovered. When I went to the doctor, she said that, you don't need to worry about, because I asked her about chronic COVID and people getting heart conditions after, you know, she said that was only for people who have been hospitalized. You don't need to worry. So, you know, I went home, and so I just relate with what you said on the show that, you know, doctors are not, especially with women, taking it seriously, because I haven't felt myself. I get winded very easily. I'm in good shape and active, 59, and, you know, so I went again to the doctor when I still had that pain. And she did an EKG finally, which made me feel a little bit better that I hadn't had a heart attack or that I'm not, you know, my heart seems strong. So that made me feel a little bit better. My winded, that I get fairly often. I feel great some days. I can bike and hike. And then other days I just feel out of breath.
Lisa, I'm really sorry to hear that you feel like your symptoms weren't taken seriously and that you know your own body, you know what you're experiencing, and that you're sort of told, don't worry about it, you're fine. There's a lot to go over here, Dr. Menson, and what we're hearing from just three of the people who are on the lines with us who are experiencing some of these long-term symptoms. And we can tease some of them apart, but one of them is there's a long list of symptoms. They're not all the same, and they're not all the same on any given day. It seems like something that can shift from one day or week to another for people who are experiencing long-term symptoms.
Correct. We know, I think the one thing that's been very difficult about this is that it seems to not be isolated to just one organ system. It seems that there's a lot that can be involved. And so trying to track this information has been really important, just because all of the symptoms and manifestations can be unique, although there can be some things that unify in the three stories we just heard. So,
yeah, talk a little bit more about that, what you are seeing as a sort of through line.
So certainly, I think, as mentioned, the fatigue has been the number one complaint I've heard from patients and described in some of the literature that we have. And then things like shortness of breath, chest pain, whether that is feels, some people say it feels like a heart attack, some people describes that as different. And then joint pains, headaches, and then there is a whole other constitution of symptoms. So people complaining of GI upset, whether that be diarrhea or vomiting, it does seem to have this very broad system involvement that can wax and wane. So some people have time periods where they feel like they've gotten better, and then they feel like they've taken a step back as well.
What does that tell us about the virus itself?
That's very difficult. It seems that maybe we're not necessarily expressing the virus in replication. So as people have mentioned, documenting recovery, so maybe having one of those negative PCR tests. I have read that there is some hypothesis that some of this might be driven either by inflammation, so dysregulation of the immune system, or remaining viral particles. So even though you may not be infectious, you may still have circulating viral particles that are kind of contributing to these manifestations.
We got a note from a listener in Burlington who mm-hmm. says, I'm a 31-year-old male, and I regard myself as active and healthy. Mm-hmm. I contracted COVID-19 in March and later tested positive in July after experiencing shortness of breath. Mm-hmm. I now have been experiencing mild fever and fatigue for 48 hours. Mm-hmm. I've read on online forums that immune systems of those who recover from COVID can go into hyperdrive similar to other diseases like Lyme or mononucleosis. Mm-hmm. Could this be plausible for my current scenario?
That's yes. So certainly if there's a change in symptoms and people are developing new fevers, I think that person should definitely be evaluated. Because anytime that there's a new change, we kind of need to know about that and make sure, as some of your listeners had mentioned, we can get bacterial superinfections, and we don't yet have any data on whether people can be reinfected with COVID itself. So evaluation by a medical provider would be very important. Now, there was a lot of information we knew early on in the disease when we were worrying about the acute illnesses regarding things called cytokine storm or the inflammatory process that was triggering a lot of the manifestations and complications we were seeing. We don't know a lot about that as far as these long haulers. So patients who continue to have symptoms this far out, we know very little about exactly what the immune system is doing at this point.
But do you think it could be a similar type of reaction to what people experience who have, what is often called long-term Lyme, or who have significant health implications after Lyme disease has, in some ways been, flushed out of their system?
Correct. I do think that there could be similarities there. And again, there's limitations in what we know and what we can say definitively, trying to find answers for patients. So looking for things that may be abnormal, like EKGs and imaging of the chest. That's why we're trying to follow these patients to really assess kind of any abnormalities we may be seeing. But similar to what patients describe as chronic Lyme syndrome, it's very difficult to pinpoint an exact cause for patients' symptoms.
A listener in Norwich also wonders about chronic fatigue syndrome, saying, listening to this, I keep thinking about chronic fatigue. What these people who had COVID are experiencing is so much like what people experience with what is called chronic fatigue syndrome. The symptoms are the same, and so is the waxing and waning. I had a moderately severe viral infection one January many years ago and never recovered, just like these folks. Has there been any research done about connecting this current syndrome after COVID with chronic fatigue syndrome?
Yes, there are experts in the chronic fatigue syndrome field who are likening this course as being very similar and trying to analyze if this is truly a manifestation of a chronic fatigue syndrome that patients are experiencing.
Can you give us a sense of the demographics? We talked about this a little bit with Emma, but you mentioned that up to 30% of COVID-19 patients, officially diagnosed COVID-19 patients, are still experiencing some symptoms 2 to 4 weeks after diagnosis. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of data on how many are experiencing it months later. But who are these people? Do they have a typical age range? Are we seeing more women? Is it typically healthy people?
So I think that's been the surprising piece of this, is we would anticipate that the patients who continue to be symptomatic would be older and have comorbid conditions or other underlying health problems that might predispose them to having a prolonged recovery phase. The data that we've seen coming out kind of across the world is that these patients can just as likely be younger without other medical problems. So while there's still a slightly higher rate of this occurring in elderly patients who have comorbid disease, it's not far off that we're also seeing young patients, so maybe in their 30s or 40s, who have no other underlying medical problems or might have mild controlled medical problems that are having these symptoms as well.
So for those who were in the hospital who were very severely ill, are they also sometimes, it sounds like sometimes they are experiencing this, but generally it's people who were not hospitalized?
Well, I think the caveat is that the inclusion of people who are otherwise younger and ill at home with these symptoms is surprising. So there certainly is an account for patients who were severely ill and had things like acute respiratory distress syndrome that are still recovering. But in some ways, that's to be expected with what we know about ARDS and some of the changes and complications that people can have either from that disease or just from having such a prolonged hospitalization.
Dr. Menson, is there any way to preordain or get an idea before it happens of who might have these long-term symptoms? I mean, you mentioned that it's surprising that some people who were able to manage their illness at home are included in the group of people who are experiencing these long-term health effects after a COVID-19 diagnosis. But is there anything that ties them together that might help us anticipate who could be experiencing these symptoms in the future?
We really haven't identified that information yet. Again, we will need more studies going forward looking at these patients when their symptoms actually do resolve or if they don't ever resolve, and looking back at things that might unify them. So as we get more numbers, being able to compare patients and if they have things leading into COVID that might explain why they're still dealing with these symptoms.
Robin wrote in to say, I tested negative for COVID-19 the first week of April after losing my sense of smell and taste and having a headache. However, since that time, my lungs are still different. Sometimes after exercising, I can feel that they are irritated. This also happens when it's humid out, even if I don't exercise. Is there a test I can have done to find out what damage, if any, I have to my lungs? Dr. Menson?
Absolutely. So we have testing to look at pulmonary function, so a variety of tests that we can do to look at how the airways respond to maneuvers and breathing. It's very similar to, it's the same test we do for patients who have asthma or COPD, and that can be very helpful when patients have symptoms that she is describing, so problems with exercise or even other exposures such as cold air, and that's called spirometry.
And so, you know, if somebody tested negative, and they're saying, but I have these symptoms. You know, what do you recommend for folks who had a negative test but still feel like something is not right and wonder if it's connected?
They should be evaluated by their primary care doctor or physician. The problem is one of two things. Possibly their COVID test could have been negative, a false negative. The other problem is that they could have simply had another viral illness that can cause very similar symptoms. So patients can get a post-viral cough or post-viral asthma-type syndrome that can present in exactly how she's describing. So making sure that you do see your doctor and you talk about these symptoms that are lingering and possible treatment options for that.
Let's go to another call. Natalie is on the line with us from Burlington. Hi, Natalie. Go right ahead.
Hi. So I'm 35. I'm healthy. In the, you know, March 12th, 13th, I had a fever and body aches for about 48 hours. And then I lost my sense of smell and taste completely for almost 2 weeks. And it did slowly start coming back. But now, almost like 6 months later, it's off. It's not right. Things taste gross. And smell weird. And I know compared to everyone else, I feel very lucky, that I don't have more of the physical symptoms, but mentally, I think it's the fact that food is so important to me. And, you know, the things that I would enjoy that I would treat myself with, I can't enjoy anymore. And so not knowing if it's ever going to be normal again is really sad. And I don't know. I mean, I had another friend in New York who had a similar problem, but then about a month ago, she got her smell and taste completely back. So I'm the only person that I know who's still, I'm sure there are other people out there. So I don't know. I was just calling because even though physically it's not the worst thing, it's just like doing a number on me emotionally.
Yeah, I can imagine not being able to smell and taste for that long, and the not knowing, Natalie, that must be so hard. Dr. Minson, what do you think?
Certainly, these are the things that patients, when they complain of, it seems fairly insignificant, but in reality, all of these things are really important quality of life markers. So even if you're dealing with one symptom that may not feel severely debilitating, the fact is that eating, being able to smell, those are quality of life markers, and it does have a significant impact on patients' lives. And the fact is that not having answers from the medical community and not knowing exactly how long these symptoms are going to last, it's very, very unsettling for patients.
So what are you doing, you know, in this regard? What is it that you're actually working on? How many patients, and how are you trying to sort of get a handle on what's happening?
So most subspecialties within the University of Vermont Medical Center have developed a capacity to follow these patients kind of based on their symptoms. Specifically in pulmonary, we have providers that are following these patients, doing initial evaluation with tests that I had mentioned, either imaging or pulmonary function testing, and then trying to follow these patients out and seeing if there's either resolution of their abnormalities on testing, or if they don't have any abnormalities on testing, following their symptoms. Certainly from the research side of things, so between UVM and UVMMC, a lot of grants going forward trying to ask specific questions about patients like this who need to be followed for months to maybe even years out as far as what happens with their symptoms.
So when you say that, you know, you can sort of follow people, the subspecialties follow the people who are experiencing symptoms, is there sort of a centralized place? Because so many of the people we're hearing from experience one thing and then it's something else, and it might be gastrointestinal for a few days, but then it might be shortness of breath and real problems with their heart. You know, is there a place where all of this is being sort of centrally located in Vermont? Because I know there are other places that this research is being done as well.
Correct. So we have some studies going on as far as registries and following patients, but additionally, the subspecialties within specifically the Department of Medicine have convened together. So physicians who have identified following these patients post-COVID and linking them in with different specialties based on their symptoms. So again, if it's shortness of breath or joint pains or patients who have persistent fevers, we've identified physicians within each group that can come together and help in a multidisciplinary fashion. So getting together as a group and discussing these patients and then making sure that they get referred to the right person for their next evaluation.
We have another listener who's sharing some symptoms. Jean in Chelsea says, I share many of the same symptoms as your callers. I contracted this illness at the end of February before they were thinking of COVID. I was given high-dose steroids, antibiotics, and albuterol for my nebulizer machine. It was thought I had post-surgical abdominal inflammation. I had almost all of the symptoms. I still have lethargy, shortness of breath, inflammation of my joints, and that crushing feeling in my chest as described by other callers. My muscles are weak and sometimes ache. I can sweat profusely in the night, and that facial numbness others mentioned. Tough stuff. So how many people are you seeing, Dr. Menson, who are experiencing something that could be attributed to COVID-19 like this?
I would say that there are probably a handful of patients at this point. I think a little disheartening as it sounds like there are many more patients out there suffering and just getting by. But the fact is that we are ready and willing to see these patients to assess them and kind of evaluate what our abnormalities might be lingering. Again, it kind of speaks to as far as the severity of Vermont. I don't want to minimize. There are certainly a lot of patients out there, and just from the number of calls we've received in this hour. But we do have, in general, a lower caseload than other places like the bigger cities that are currently dealing even with, again, surges in cases. So while our numbers are small, we certainly know that there are patients out there who are still dealing with symptoms and, again, happy to see them.
So should people get in touch with you if they think that this is what they're dealing with? I mean, I imagine, judging by the number of calls that we've had, there are people who are feeling isolated in their symptoms or who aren't getting treatment. But, you know, I don't want them to suddenly call the UVM Medical Center if this isn't something that you're able to sort of accommodate. You know, what should people do?
Well, certainly having discussions with primary care, and I hear the concern from people about being felt that their symptoms are validated. So hopefully being able to be in touch with their provider and advocate for things that they feel like they need. We also are developing a support group for post-COVID survivors, specifically to also talk about patients who continue to have these symptoms. And that is one way that we can provide resources directly in a facilitated manner to help people get tuned in with the resources they need.
Were you surprised by how many calls we got of people saying they're experiencing this, or not surprised?
I guess I'm not surprised. I assumed that when people kind of heard and were validated in their symptoms, and especially the media has been reporting about this in the past couple of weeks to month, I believe people are starting to recognize that they're not alone. I'm glad to hear from patient stories. I hate to hear that people are still suffering, but I hope that it's validating to hear that they are backed up in what they've been dealing with.
It must be hard for patients too, though, when they're experiencing some of these symptoms. But, you know, I don't know whether you do antibody testing or whether you sort of look to see if this is COVID related, and if it's not, have to say to a patient, I'm sorry, I believe what you're experiencing, but it's not related to COVID-19.
Right. That's a difficult spot right now because we don't know what the antibody testing really tells us. Certainly, patients probably feel validated if they've had a positive COVID test. But the patients who either had negative testing or were unable to get testing, that will be a very tricky thing to deal with and assess. But again, when patients have symptoms and complaints, we're here to investigate that, to evaluate that, and to think of possibilities, whether they're COVID related or not, in ways to hopefully get them feeling better.
Is there a long-term prognosis yet for people who are experiencing these long-term symptoms? I know we're so new to this virus that maybe not, but, you know, do you think most people will recover or mostly recover?
I'm very hopeful that will be the case. We do have some information from prior coronavirus outbreaks, so SARS and MERS data that predated this, where some patients did have persistent and long-term fatigue. It's difficult to extrapolate on that data, though, because the numbers from those outbreaks were so much smaller than what we're dealing with now.
Sarah in Barton says, I'm wondering if the continued symptoms are a sign of our body not being able to kick out the virus, and will a vaccination, even for people who have already been diagnosed, boost our immune systems to be able to do that?
That is a difficult question because I think we need to know exactly what's causing these symptoms. So again, if we think that this is an inflammatory response, I'm not sure that a vaccination would necessarily help with that. If this is remaining viral particles, not necessary in replication, but causing a response within people's bodies in certain organ systems or throughout, that's going to be a different story. But I don't think we're going to have that information until we really know more about the vaccine.
Are there any promising treatments on the horizon?
For the long haulers?
Yeah.
We have looked at certain types of things that might help with the anti-inflammatory treatment, so medications that we use for other inflammatory conditions, but nothing yet as far as information on whether that's effective or not.
You know, I think for many youngish, you know, middle-aged people who think of themselves as healthy, a lot of the focus has been on making sure not to spread the virus to those who are more vulnerable, rather than people in that category necessarily thinking of themselves as super vulnerable to this disease. And, you know, one of the questions about the long haulers is that I think it scares a lot of people who said, I think I'll be fine. I just want to make sure I don't give it to my grandmother or to somebody next door who might now be reevaluating their own risk level for this virus. Dr. Menson, how do you think healthy, young, and middle-aged people should evaluate their level of risk with this new understanding of what might happen after contracting the virus?
I think we need to just keep in mind that there are certainly younger people who did get sick and, may have had milder symptoms, but again, we're seeing this long-term complication. So I think being responsible, being respectful to others, but that certainly is a concern. We're seeing this disease more than just in elderly patients.
Dr. Catherine Menson is an adult pulmonologist and ICU intensivist at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Menson, thank you very much for giving us so much of your time and helping us understand this.
Thank you so much for having me.